people, welcome to Have Guitar Will Travel, presented by Vintage Guitar Magazine, with your host, me, James Patrick Regan, otherwise known as Jimmy from the Deadlies. And today I'm speaking with singer-guitarist Steve Wynn from the Dream Syndicate and the Baseball Project, as well as solo. In our conversation, Steve tells us about his current tour schedule and living in Queens, New York for the past 30 years, and Steve tells us about his adventures in New York City in the 80s. Steve talks about his childhood and growing up musically in L.A., buying sheet music at the neighborhood music store. Steve describes his alternate passion early on as a sports writer and going to UC Davis, where he met Kendra Smith, the eventual bass player for the Dream Syndicate. Steve takes us through the guitars he's used throughout the years and what he's using now on stage, mostly Fenders and an Epiphone Riviera, and his struggles with the Jazzmaster, and the lack of needing an amp when he's touring. And he describes his pedal chain, including a signature pedal made by Roos. Steve describes why the Dream Syndicate had a limited presence on MTV, yet a big European following. To find out more about Steve, you can go to his website, stevewynn.net. That's stevewynn.net, which will also take you to the Dream Syndicate website. Please subscribe, like, comment, share, and most of all, review this podcast. I'd really appreciate it. And please support Vintage Guitar Magazine and all the wonderful things they do for us guitar players, because they do so many wonderful things for us guitar players. Here's my buddy Steve. Hey there, Steve.
Hey.
Well, it's nice to meet you.
Yeah, good to meet you too, James.
And your shirt says...
Yes, it's Twang.
Yeah. What's it in reference to?
Twang is it's a club in Stockholm I played a few months ago and really liked. It's
okay.
A great venue out over there, and I had quite a couple nights over there, and you know, I dig the logo, the name, and the club. So
sure.
I'm happy to plug them in if possible.
Exactly. It's
that's one thing about touring. One thing about touring is you get a lot of free T-shirts.
There's nothing wrong with that. You know, we could always use more T-shirts.
That's my Muppets cup. So I'm all set.
It says Twang, but it's more like a sort of a cosmic kind of font on the Twang.
It is. It's like, I don't know. It's like Twang and Prague at the same time.
Yeah. That's... You have quite the CD collection behind you.
Yeah. What are you going to do with them? You know, at this point, it's like, you know, they're mainly there for reference at this point, to look up things, to look at booklets and things like that, and then, or to burn to a computer, unfortunately, you know. But I like them. They're little reminders of things I've done and listened to in places I've been in the last, 30 years. So
sure, I
like
sure.
them. Yeah.
You grew up in L.A.? Are you living in L.A. right now?
No, I've lived in New York City for 30 years.
Oh, really? Oh, right on. Right on.
Yeah, I'm speaking to you right now from home in Jackson Heights, Queens, New York.
Oh, very good. And what drew you to New York?
Oh, I always loved the city. I came here for the first time on a Greyhound bus in 1981, and I wrote about that in my book, and just felt like this is where I belong, and for the next 10 years... I'd tour here on and off with the Dream Syndicate and on my solo tours, and every time I came, I was brokenhearted when I had to leave. So the first chance I had to live here, an apartment came up, and I said, great, let's see how that goes, and I guess it went, because 30 years, I'm still here.
Did you feel like a fish out of water growing up in the Los Angeles area?
I mean, that'd be a romantic way to look at it, but actually the reality is, I loved L.A. then. I still like going there now. You know, it wasn't like, oh, it was, always meant to live here, although I sure do like living here. But once I did live here, it just suits my pace better. You know, I like, well, besides the fact, simple things, really obvious things, like I really like walking, and we all know L.A. has a bad reputation for that. Not fully deserved. There are places to walk in L.A., but New York is a very communal city. You're out walking around, you're surrounded by people, as a writer, you're more... open to a lot of stimuli that you wouldn't be if you're just sitting in your car all the time.
Sure.
I like that. And also, if I think about my favorite writers and film and directors and musicians and songwriters, everything, most of them are from here. I was, my Paisley Underground pals were all into, Love and the Beach Boys and whatever, and that's fine by me too, but I was always more of a Ramones, Velvet Underground, Television,
sure.
kind of guy myself.
Yeah, it shows in your music, for sure.
It does.
Yeah. Did you ever have a chance to go to some of the iconic clubs in New York when they were still open?
Yeah, just barely. Actually, the Dream Syndicate played CBGB's, and in fact, a good portion of our new box set was recorded at a show CBGB's in 1983.
Okay.
I probably played there 5 or 6 times, so I think about that now, it seems like such a long-departed venue,
yeah.
Like mythic.
Yes.
But actually, at the place where I played.
Yeah.
I went to Max's Kansas City once. That was, you know, and I played the bottom line. So a few of these places, you know. You know, it's funny. I'm reading the book about Bruce Springsteen making Born to Run right now. It just came out. And good book. And they talk a lot about a kind of a career-changing, career-accelerating, whatever, gig for him at the bottom line. Uh-huh. And how, you know, it was a very important thing. And I can visualize the backstage. I can visualize the load-in. I can visualize all that. So I'm glad I had experiences of some of these places because not only, you know, well, it makes me, you know, I just had these great memories. And I can visualize these moments in seemingly distant rock history that aren't that distant. You know, it's funny. When I read about, for example, the thing I just mentioned, with this Bruce Springsteen gig there in 1975 that, you know, that kind of, put him and Born to Run on the, you know, the mass consciousness. And I think by 1975, to me, that sounds like, you know, it is my childhood. It is like ancient history. It is something that I remember, you know, from high school. On the other hand, it's only like a handful of years before the Dream Syndicate started. You know, from that moment till our first record is 7 years, which seems like a blip now. It seems like nothing now.
Sure.
And it sounds like I wait 7 years to make a record sometime now. So like, it's just funny how. You know, if you're a rock historian or just fan in general, how things, you know, objects in the rearview mirror can often seem closer than they appear. Whatever the weird expression is.
Yes, exactly. To quote Meatloaf.
Or Jim. Exactly. Which I don't often.
Were you musically aware when you were in L.A.?
Very much so. I'm just, you know, now the music fanatic. You know, beyond just like that's my background and the thing I bob around to. I was, you know, I was born to be a record geek. You know, from the time I was 5 years old. You know, uh-huh. I always was. You know, I think from the time I could read, I was reading liner notes and credits. You know, that was always in my DNA. So, you know, that influenced a lot. You know, a lot of what I do. But I say, you know, I was just talking to somebody the other day about how my generation of musicians, and by my generation, I mean Dream Syndicate, REM, that sort of my gang, you know, whatever. Most of us worked in record stores. You know, most of the Baseball Project and the Dream Syndicate and Steve and the Miracle 3, if you look at those bands, almost everybody worked in record stores. And I think that kind of is a reason for that because, you know, if you're of that, the 80s indie rock scene was really made up of super fans, people who just were, you know, loved and collected and thought about and debated music and used that kind of that tendency in the record we made, you know, that arrogant belief in this is good, this is not good, you know, that high fidelity kind of attitude played into our own way of making music. It wasn't so much, you know, Grant, yeah, I'm for sure all these bands wrote and tried to probe the heavens and write poetry and write heavy things from their soul. Yes. But also, we just were saying, this is good music and you need to hear it. So rather than put a record on the turntable, play it for you, I'm going to form a band and write songs like that so you can hear it. Yeah, same kind of spirit.
Yeah. Yeah, right on. When did you start playing guitar?
I started playing guitar when I was 8 years old.
Oh, right on.
1968. And got my first acoustic guitar and took lessons and that was that.
And were you playing songs like Tom Dooley or?
Did you just name that out of the blue or did you know that?
I just remember when I was starting playing guitar, that was definitely part of the songbook that we chose from.
I guess that's at the first song I ever learned. That's when I just blew my mind. That was the first song I ever learned from my guitar teachers. That just cracked me up. That's amazing. Yes, indeed. Tom Dooley. And just learning the parts of learning how to play those chords in the first three strings, the G chord with one note, you know, and that sort of thing, and playing Tom Dooley, and quickly went from that because I was such a music fan. I went from that so quickly to hanging at the Carl Fisher Music Store in Westwood and looking at sheet music for Creedence songs and Beatles songs and whatever I was into, and I would just, you know, I couldn't always afford them. Whether it was a banner day when I could buy a sheet music for a song I like.
Oh, yeah,
I would go there and look at the store and just stare at them for a long time, try to memorize what I was looking at. Okay, I think I got it now. Wow, okay. That's how he plays that chord. Great. Run home and try to replicate that. So, yeah, I very quickly went from guitar lessons to just learning from my record collection and picking up on things.
Were there, like, neighborhood bands that you could go see?
Not Not at that age. In L.A., I probably mostly, but definitely in L.A. at that time, I couldn't go to bars. I couldn't go to the Whiskey A Go-Go or the Troubadour. I don't think Troubadour might have been all ages for some shows, but, you know, going to a club show didn't have much. I did go a lot to arena shows. I was lucky to have an older sister who would drag me along to shows by, you know, The Who and Elton John, Led Zeppelin, and, you know, and Alice Cooper especially. I was a big fan.
Yeah.
So I would go see the bands that would play the L.A. Forum, you know, to 20,000 people, and or the Hollywood Bowl or the Greek Theater.
Yeah.
That I could do. My closest thing to local bands before I was of age was the rare couple of times when I happened to walk by a garage on the street and hear a band rehearsing in the garage.
Sure, sure.
And that was like just... You know, I talk about it in my book. One of my earliest memories is being 7 or 8 years old and walking past a garage and hearing a band playing and thinking, what is going on? How is that even possible? How can there be music happening be on the other side of that wall?
Yeah.
And I had to really wrap my head around that. And I just was so excited. I'm sure maybe as much as anything, that was the moment that put me in the direction of doing what I do. I think just like that seemed like the greatest magic trick of all time.
Yeah.
And it still does. It kind of still does. Sometimes I think about, you know, I played my last show a week ago at the Baseball Project. I'll think about how do five people walk on stage and just will this kind of music into being? It's we all take it for granted, you know, either as musicians or fans, but it is kind of a cool little trick that you can combine with other people and voila, this sound comes out.
Were you playing in bands in high school?
No, I played in bands older than that. I played in bands like from the age of 9 to 13.
Oh, okay.
And bands would actually, you know, would practice a lot and even did a few gigs. At 13, I kind of, you know, I was pretty serious. I had a Telecaster. I was pretty decent. And at 13, I kind of pushed it by the side to become a sports writer.
That
became
suddenly
my passion at age 13, largely because, in hindsight, because music changed a lot in the early 70s, where all of a sudden... The kind of things I love, like The Who and Creedence and The Stones and all that. Well, all those bands stayed big, but it became more supplanted by bands like Yes and Emerson, Lake and Palmer.
Sure.
And Genesis playing a kind of music which I didn't hate, but I could not see myself doing.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess I sort of, at points, started thinking, well, and it wasn't a conscious decision, but I'm sure I felt like, well, that's not for me, so what do I want to do? Oh, no. I like sports. I'm a writer. I'll write about sports. And that stuck for like 4 years. I didn't play in any bands from age 13 to 18 until punk rock came along and just changed my life with like a steamroller. Just everything. When the 77 came along and the Pistols and the Ramones and the Clash, I went, that's it. You know, goodbye sports writing. Hello again, guitar bands.
Oh, yeah. Not to belabor it, but what was your sports? What sports were you interested in?
Well, I was covering everything. I was really bad. That's really what I wanted to do with my life. That in those years, I was very passionate about it, and, you know, as a sports fan, but also as a sports writer. So I would cover, you name it. I mean, everything from football, basketball, baseball, to fencing and lacrosse.
Oh,
I mean,
wow.
If people were playing it, I was covering it. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed doing that. Yeah. It's funny because, you know, I was kind of on the fast track. I was writing it for a local newspaper, and I'm sure had I kept at it, I probably would have done that for a living and been pretty successful.
Uh-huh.
My best friend back in those days, kind of the guy who was a year younger and who was, you know, sort of studying for me, I guess, whatever, became a very successful sports writer.
Oh,
I just saw him last week, and he ended up being one of the top sports writers in the country and did, you know, just a great guy, and we were still friends. Uh-huh. And we talk all the time, and I realize, you know, his life and my life are similar in a lot of ways. You know, when he was really going at it, he was traveling from town to town, had a different gig every night, had to do or die. There was no time to belabor. It's like, you know, here you are, get it done. And that's about what I do on stage, what you were doing in the press box, same kind of thing.
Yeah. Did you play sports at all?
No, terrible.
That makes it easy.
Yeah, it makes it easy. Those who can't play sports, I'm right. I don't know. I would fool around. I mean, I have fun. I'd throw the ball around in the schoolyard or whatever. But I was never an athlete.
Did you get an opportunity to see the Sex Pistols?
I sure did. I saw their last original concert. They finished their only U.S. tour at Winterland, San Francisco. And I there, and I was there, and so it seems like half the world was that show. In retrospect, but I really was there.
Yeah. What? If I'm not, didn't the Bay City Rollers play also at that show?
No, I love that. That's a great idea. It was the Pistols, the Avengers, and the Nuns.
Oh, okay. All right. All right. Yeah. very good. Maybe they broadcast that show on TV in the Bay Area. And I think they half of it was the Sex Pistols and the other half was the Bay City Rollers. So that's why I have it in my head that they played together.
That's really funny. I mean, I imagine I would have been on KSAN, the station I listened to religiously back then.
Yeah.
And if they were playing the Bay City Rollers, it had to have been ironic because that wasn't the normal fare. That's pretty funny. Not surprising. I mean, they were pretty radical stations. I could see them doing something like that just to make some point or another. Yeah. Or make a point.
You went to UC Davis, correct?
I did.
Yeah. What were you studying at UC Davis?
Rhetoric.
Rhetoric?
I was a rhetoric major. That's why I went to Davis. I don't know. I when I went to Davis, I still wanted to be a sports writer. I went there with the idea that's what I was going to do. I even became sports editor of the paper in my first semester.
Wow.
It was crazy. I was pretty good. and I think the logic I had was, well, I don't want to major in journalism. What's the thing that would be most effective as a writer? And somehow I got in my head that rhetoric is a good idea because if you can make a convincing case for something, you can probably do anything. And maybe that's true. You know, rhetoric was usually pre-law. It was usually but I just saw it as a way to become a writer. And I got to say, well, for one thing, I met Kendra Smith, who became bass player in the Dream Syndicate, in a rhetoric class. So.
Okay. All right.
So I chose the right field.
Yes, you did.
My life wouldn't have been the same had I not met Kendra. So though, I guess I chose the right major.
You mentioned having a Telecaster when you were 13. Do you still have the Telecaster? And what were you using for AM?
It's a sad story. The happy part of the story is actually age 11. I got it at 11. My sister was married at the time to a guy who was an executive at Columbia.
Wow.
I mean, the music. He was like based in Nashville, and he knew I played guitar, and he said, you know, I can get you a cheap Fender guitar, because they had just bought CBS had just bought Fender, of course. And so I said, oh, God. So I got this beautiful blonde Telecaster for, I think, $85 or $90.
Wow.
Which was, it was a gorgeous guitar that I shouldn't have, like, 11-year-old had no right of having, but boy, I love that guitar.
Sure.
And I played it and played in a few bands. I went to Davis to school. I was moving into my first apartment there, and it got stolen out of my apartment while I was moving in. Yeah, what happened? I was moving stuff up and down the stairs to the apartment, and end of the night, I said, well, it's time to pull out my guitar and play a little music in my new place, and open it up, and there were wood blocks inside the guitar case.
Oh my God!
Somebody had not only stolen the guitar, but they put wood blocks in it, to fool me into thinking, who knows? The guy's pretty clever.
Oh, yeah.
And so by that time, it was gone, and no hope of getting it back. And I didn't have really any money at the time. I was working, you know, whatever I could do. So I wasn't going to get a Telecaster. So I went down to the local pawn shop and got a '64 Mustang for $60.
Oh, right.
A cherry red. A guitar that now would be a $5,000 guitar, probably. But yeah, you know, yeah. I got that. And for the next 4 years, I would trade up. I essentially would get a new guitar, take my guitar, trade it in, add $40 and get a new one. And I went from the Mustang to a Jaguar to a Jazzmaster. And just, you know, my goal was to get back to having a Telecaster.
Yeah.
So basically along the way, I traded in invaluable, beautiful guitars all along the way just to get back to a Telecaster. I cry now when I think about the guitars I got rid of. But I did finally get a Telecaster again in 1984, and I still play it today.
Oh, right on. Right on. Do you have a guitar collection?
I was just talking to somebody about it. I'm looking at this assessment. My eyes are wandering to a few of them right now. I have, there's a cheap, way in the back is a cheap nylon string that doesn't count. I have about 15, including acoustic, electric, bass, 12 string. So not, you know, not a crazy amount. I use them all.
Uh-huh. Yeah, of course.
I don't have anything that doesn't get played for some thing or another.
Yeah, and mostly on stage, you're using Jazz Masters and the Telecaster?
No, I have a Jazz. I recently got a, well, not, we played now, it's like 10 years ago now. I got one of those 62 Olympic Jazz Master reissues.
Yeah.
Got a nice deal on it via my association with the REM camp, so thank you to those guys.
Uh-huh.
And I don't play that one often enough. These days, I'm playing primarily, I'm looking at 69 Competition Mustang,
uh-huh.
Various Telecasters. My wife, Linda, who's also the drummer of the Baseball Project, got me the 40-year reissue Telecaster a couple of years ago. It's like the gold hardware.
Yeah.
And I love it. I got it with the idea it was going to be my beater, my knock around town, the one I could take on the subway, the one I wouldn't worry about. And also I've fallen in love with it, and I play it all the time now. So that's funny. And I've got this over here. My latest addition to the family is this.
Oh, wow. The casino.
Yeah. It's the Riviera.
Riviera.
Okay. The new reissue that I'm going to play on the coming Dream Syndicate tour, because I was playing one like that, an original, back in when we toured for Medicine Show. And I went, if I want to try to recreate those times, I'll recreate the guitar. So I got one. It's almost identical. So that's my new baby.
When you started Dream Syndicate, what were you using back then?
Jazzmaster.
Okay.
A little bit of Jaguar, but mainly a Jazzmaster I had. I think it was a 64. I'm not quite sure.
Uh-huh.
Sunburst Jazzmaster. That's what I made Days of Wine and Roses with, that guitar, all our earliest touring. And, of course, it's a great guitar. Jason Victor, the guitarist of Dream Syndicate, plays one like that now. But I, as you probably know, those guitars are as great as they are, and as unique as they are and all that, they're hard to maintain. And this is before the days of mastery bridges.
Yes,
so my
exactly.
bridge,
yeah.
I spend every day, every gig, putting matchsticks under the bridge to try to keep the bridge from falling, keep the strings from buzzing.
Yeah.
Then I'd be using the Allen wrench to intonate it, and just was an endless chasing of I fix that one, now that one's messed up. And so I didn't, at the time, I knew it was a great guitar. I was a big fan of Tom Verlaine, and he played one. And and I liked that Elvis Costello had played one.
Sure.
And I knew, and I liked that it was called Jazzmaster. And it was beautiful. But at the same time, I kept thinking, man, if I ever get any kind of money, I can't wait to get a dependable guitar, like a Telecaster again. So when I got the Telecaster, once again, traded that Jazzmaster. And I'm sad about it now, but had it, like I say, I love that mastery bridge. When I put that on my new one, it was like the angels sang, I can hit the whammy bar and we'll stay in tune. Oh.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
By the way, I love this interview. This is my favorite stuff to talk about.
Oh, good. But what about amps? What were you using for amps back then?
Yeah, when I was starting out, I don't remember what in the world I played when I was, 10, 11, 12. I don't remember what I would play back then, but I did play. I had a very heavy and cumbersome twin throughout my college years.
Wow.
And I played that. I think I had that through all the early Dream Syndicate on Days of Wine and Roses.
Wow.
And I don't know why I had it. I can't remember the circumstance where I got that. It was probably a 70s twin. I don't know what year it was. It was just heavy, and I never loved the sound. I always felt it'd be kind of too much, for the gigs I was playing.
Sure.
And just too glassy, and I had to kind of wrangle to get the sound out. Of course, like I play on Days of Wine and Roses, and I like what that sounds like, so I can't complain.
Uh-huh.
But I did play that for a while. I had a little Champ amp that I, probably a 70s Champ.
Yep.
The Carl Pakoda, the other guitarist of Dream Syndicate, appropriated from me, and that's what he would play through all the time. And
wow.
He got that great sound. He's now our earliest shows and Days of Wine and Roses, he used that little Champ, and was just, that was his sound. I missed that one.
Did you have to use a pedal to get the twin to break up?
I had, because back then there weren't that many pedal options, I had an MXR Distortion Plus I used, and that's
sure.
kind of, but I wouldn't use it for my basic rhythm. That was mainly a solo sound.
Okay.
So I pretty much would get whatever I could get out of the amp. And my role in the early, in those Dream Syndicate days, was to be kind of clang, 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 the treble clang, clang against Carl's noise and distortion and feedback.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't really need it to break up.
Yeah.
Just get a nice clang, and those two things worked well enough together.
Yeah.
So it was fine. Eventually, we the Dream Syndicate signed to A&M Records, and so we were able to kind of say we need this, we need that. It was big fun for a while.
Yeah.
And for some reason, somebody told me I needed to get a Mesa Boogie combo, which I don't know why. Lord knows. And when we signed to A&M, we did, you know, pretty much now, of course, it was all recoupable and we had to, you know, theoretically pay for it, which we never did because we never recouped. But we had all this gear that we got, you know, from them, a Yamaha CP70 piano and a Hammond organ and my Mesa Boogie and Carl got a Marshall stack and blah, blah, blah. The following year, after that record, we sold everything. It was like, great, we're selling it all. We actually sold our organ and piano to REM. That was great. And then took the money and got amps we really wanted. And I bought, from, I don't know if you know Green on Red, I'm Dan's, Dan Stewart from Green on Red, Chuck Provost. Well, Dan Stewart had this little 60s vibe reverb that, you know, he just, you know, I won't even speculate why he needed quick money. You know, he's, let's say he did. And I said, well, he said, if you want this little vibe reverb, I'll sell it to you for $200. I said, yes. And that amp I used for like the next 20 years. That's the greatest amp.
Yeah.
That was the sound. I used it basically till it just fell apart and couldn't be fixed anymore.
Yeah, very cool. So you mentioned that you got signed to A&M. How did that process happen? How are they even aware of you?
Well, we were kind of the hot band at the time.
Oh, okay. In LA.
I say that with no needed modesty in the U.S.
Okay.
I'd say early 83... we were that band. I'm not saying we were, you know, filling stadiums or, you know, whatever, but we're the band that every cool record store person and radio, college radio DJ and rock critic said, that's my favorite band. We were the great hope for that scene for a good 6 months to a year.
Okay.
And I know what that was like because I was such a music fan. I've seen other bands be that band. I've seen television and, you know, Talking Heads and whatever, maybe I'm trying to think of bands just before me that might have fit that role as well. Echo and the Bunnymen, I don't know, like bands like people all agree for one moment that that's my favorite band. We were that band, and so it coincided with a period where we were available and it was a big bidding war. We talked to a lot of labels and chose the one we wanted to be on most.
Yeah.
It was fun. It was weird and heady and a little bit of fun, and it was you know, destined to not last, but you know, we had most of it.
How come they never put you on MTV or rarely put you on to MTV?
There's a good reason for that, actually. And we made our first real video for the title track to Out of the Gray, our third album. And that was actually played on MTV every day for about 2 months. Okay. It was actually pretty hard to believe now that that would happen. But MTV was more, you know, wide open back then.
Yeah.
But the reason we weren't really on MTV is kind of a funny story that worked out pretty well. Once the record came out, I was pretty much managing the band. I became the manager of the band, and I still self-managed. Uh-huh. And I had a meeting with the head of A&R, and he said, look, Steve, we got a choice for you. You can either, we will either make, you know, a very expensive MTV video for you guys. And, you know, back in those days, an MTV video was $100,000 or whatever.
You
didn't make them on your iPhone like you would now. And they said, we'll either make a video for you, or we'll finance a European tour. And to be honest, I'd never been to Europe in my life, and I wanted to go. Mm-hmm. The rest of the band felt the same way. And we figured, sure, we'll take that. And it was the best decision I ever made, because that tour in 1984, we were sort of over there ahead of all the other bands of our scene. You know, whether if you want to talk about those 80s bands, like the ones I've mentioned, we were the first to go there on that level. And I think we really, you know, it built the foundation for a career that I still have quite strongly, so it was great.
Yeah.
So that meant, you know, we weren't the MTV, you know, glamour boys, but we built a nice European touring life, and that's fantastic.
When you tour now, what do you bring in for as far as amps and guitars? I mean, you mentioned that you mentioned the Telecaster and that, but
yeah, it's funny. Guitars, I'll bring, you know, whichever one I think will fit that tour. You know, whatever one seems like the right guitar for that tour. Use the Telecaster or the Mustang or now this Epiphone these days. Those are kind of my main. Or acoustic. I do a lot of solo acoustic touring.
And okay.
I have a Guild D50 I take out.
Wow, you know. Big guitar.
Yeah. Yeah, it is, actually. And I have this weird thing called an Alhambra, I guess you would say, Spanish steel string guitar.
Yeah.
Not the nylon, steel string.
Yeah.
Those are my two main acoustic guitars I drag around. But for amps, this is a funny thing. I don't have an amp. This is the weirdest thing. I've lived in New York long enough now where if I'm playing locally, most clubs in New York these days have an amp. And if I'm playing in Europe, we generally rent things. And most of my touring lately has been with the Baseball Project, and Peter Buck keeps amplifiers in Athens and Portland, his two kind of main towns.
Okay.
So I usually use one of his. And I've always like a little Pro Junior I just knock used to rehearse on.
Yeah.
Peter is he's a big proponent of this amp called Good Cell. Do you know it's a Georgia amp company?
I think so, yes. I've heard of it.
Fantastic. They're great. He's got like 20 of them. He always just loves that. It's a hand-wired, you know, a boutique amp.
Yeah, yeah.
One guy's name, Roger Goodsell.
Yes.
And they sound like AC-30s with a little more of a Fender clarity.
Uh-huh.
Just for me, the perfect mix of a great Fender and a great AC-30. And so I always play those with Peter, and I think he's decided he wants to keep one of his amps in New York. So I said, great, I will gladly house it for you. So I think I'll finally have an amp. they're amazing amps. He doesn't make them anymore, so they're kind of but they're on Reverb and stuff. They're
sure.
Just the dream amp. It's man, that's these days. I guess I didn't have an amp for a long time, and I finally do again.
is that what you're going to use when you do the Dream Syndicate Medicine Show coming up, the tour?
I'm not on the West Coast because I'll use one of Peter's amps starting in Portland. On the East Coast, yes. And in Europe, it's Europe, so we'll just rent things over there. And I'll generally use I generally like using a deluxe reverb. If somebody at the festival or rental company says, what do you want? That's kind of my first choice, you know.
Sure. Yeah. And are you using any pedals now? Any pedals before the amp?
Oh, yeah. I'm not as bad. I'm definitely not as bad as some, but, you know. I actually have a great company, pedal company out of Denmark called Reuss, R-E-U-S-S. I don't know if you know them.
Yeah, of course.
You know, nice. Okay, well, they made a custom pedal for me. They made a Wine and Roses pedal.
Oh, right on.
Yeah, I said I want a pedal kind of based on, you know, on a distortion plus, an early distortion plus, and maybe it's a good boss overdrive. And they use a two-in-one kind of pedal for me. It looks like the cover of Days of Wine and Roses.
Right on.
Beautiful pedal. So I kind of tend to use my own pedal, especially with the Dream Syndicate.
Yeah.
And then I'll use like generally a carbon copy delay and a Topanga Catalan Brett Topanga reverb. That's kind of my go-to triple thing. Although on the baseball project tour we just finished last week, I knew I'd be playing a lot more lead guitar because I was playing lead. Our opening band was the Minus Five, which is the band of Scott McCoy, who's the other singer in the baseball project.
Yeah.
So we were our opening band. He said, Steve, you're going to be the lead guitarist for that set.
Uh-huh.
I'd never been the lead guitarist in a band before. I was always like the second banana. I take a few solos, but somebody else was taking the lion's share. I've always been fine with that. But this is the first time I've been the lead guitarist and first time I was not the singer. So I thought long and hard about a pedal that would be kind of a weird, wild card pedal. And I got the knife drop, the Jack White knife drop pedal.
Uh-huh.
And used it, and I love it. I had a lot of fun with that. So that was kind of my latest little joy.
Yeah. So when you fly out to the West Coast, how does the pedal board get there?
Oh boy, I feel this now. This confession time. I really had been for a long time just throwing it in my suitcase and letting it rip. And a couple of pedals got damaged, and I think that's probably why. So,
yeah.
what I tend to do now, I'll either carry the whole pedal board, which is a pain, of course, or I'll take my pedal board, you know, pack the board, leave on the disposable pedals on the board, wrap it up real tight, and carry the nice pedals with me on board.
Yeah.
I'm growing up about on that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I'm a little less devil may care.
Yeah. How about your guitars? Do you have Colton cases or something similar?
I'm using the mono cases for most things.
Mm-hmm.
I like them a lot. I like them because if I'm forced to check them, I feel pretty secure. You know, I'll pad them out. But also I can bring them on board and usually don't get pushback on that. So they work pretty well. Do you have any advice? Is there something you like?
You know what? I'm not flying on your level.
Okay.
So to be fair, I use is the Colton cases because they do put up with just about any, you know, any kind of flight kind of thing, situation where they get thrown around and beat on. The guitar seems to hold up pretty good. When I've used regular hard shell cases, mm-hmm. they for one thing, they're, you know, every airline's different, but nowadays it's tough to get them to let you put it in the overhead, even if it's small enough.
And it's gotten harder for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm just scared to put in anything that's kind of soft and put it in the overhead. Cause people are just jamming their crap up there. So.
Yes. I've developed strategies over the years. If I'm traveling with somebody, we do a tag team thing where, you know, kind of put commandeer the whole bin, but it's gotten harder.
It's difficult. I've shipped my guitar via UPS ahead of myself. And done it that way, but you know, I've also bought a guitar where I was playing, and used it.
I get that, and then do you take it home or do you just? You know?
I sold it. One time I took it home after I was done. I just shipped it home after I was done.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I thought about going to Europe and buying a guitar and selling at the end of the tour, which probably would work just fine, but I haven't tried that out.
Well, you have the advantage of being able to sell it at your merch booth on your last show.
I've thought about that. I've never done that, but I've actually thought about that. It probably would work. That's really funny you say that. there's probably that one guy who, hey, they're nice guitars. It's not like, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, nobody's gonna want my guitar after I'm done.
Oh yeah, I know the person who bought Tom Verlaine's Marquee Moon Jazzmaster.
Oh really?
And she's not a guitarist. This is heartbreaking. And I don't question her desire to have it and that she has the money at the time to own it. But it's like, oh, that thing is meant to be played.
Oh yeah. Well, being associated with Vintage Guitar Magazine, I do know of a lot of people that have large collections that are, you know, sit on walls. And it's tough. It's tough. But what are you gonna do? I can't afford them. So
yeah.
So.
I gotta say, this is my favorite interview I've done in ages.
Thank you very much, Steve. Yeah. Well, I'm in Napa, California, so you're playing in San Francisco. Oh. Hopefully, I can come and check you out at the bottom of the hill.
I'd love to meet you there. So
right on. Likewise. Okay. It'd be a pleasure. It'd be an honor. Right on. Very good. Thank you very much, Steve. Okay. I appreciate it. Right. Have a great afternoon.
You too.
Okay, bye-bye. Thanks for listening to Have Guitar, Will Travel. You can catch up on all the things I'm doing at thedeadlies.com. And I'm on all the social media platforms as well. And please support Vintage Guitar and all the wonderful things they do, because they do many, many wonderful things for us guitar players. Thanks. Please subscribe. Please tell a friend. And I'll see you guys next week. Bye, guys.